The second case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Vincent Fasthorse. Mr. Fasthorse is the appellant and is represented by Ms. Tracy Smith, an attorney from Sioux Falls. State of South Dakota is represented by Mr. Andrew Connect, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Justice Severson has disqualified himself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Richard Sabers, retired justice of this court, to sit in Justice Sabers, or in Justice Severson's behalf. Ms. Smith, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. There were four issues that I raised in my brief, but to the extent that issue four deals with all the charges, the case as a whole, I would like to address that issue first. If I do have enough time, I would like to go into issues one and two. However, if the court has any specific questions that you would like for me to address, I would be happy to start there. Briefly, the facts in this case were on September 14th, plans were made for Ms. Sanchez to attend a party with my client, Vincent Fasthorse. Fasthorse arrived as planned, and he and two other individuals, along with Ms. Sanchez, stopped at a liquor store before heading to a party where they picked up several items of alcohol. At the party, many people were drinking to the point that some people were so intoxicated they were passing out. Ms. Sanchez and Mr. Fasthorse made plans to leave, although Ms. Sanchez's cousin also attended the party with them. She stayed at the house. Sanchez arrived home the following morning at approximately 7 a.m. and told her mother, who had been caring for her daughter the night before, that she had been raped. Issue four dealt with the inability to fully cross-examine Ms. Sanchez, and that inability denied him his right to confront and cross-examine the witness pursuant to the Sixth Amendment. At the time of trial, Ms. Sanchez was serving a 90-day sentence for maintaining a residence where drugs were used or sold. She testified that she had smoked marijuana the day of the incident. However, the trial court held that the events surrounding her arrest as to that incident were irrelevant and inadmissible. The U.S. Supreme Court has stated that the opportunity to cross-examine any prosecution witness is central to the fundamental right of confrontation and is important to conduct an effective defense.
Now, you were obviously able to cross-examine her as to the incidents of this particular charge.
That's correct. However,
so how is your inability to cross-examine her on a charge not connected with the rape and kidnapping prejudicial to you?
For one thing, it went to the issue of bias. The prosecutor that called her as a witness was also the same office that had worked out her a plea agreement. She was charged with several charges where she was facing, if found guilty on the maximum penalty, something like 25 years in the penitentiary. She had worked out a plea agreement where she only received 90 days in jail.
Was that in exchange for her testimony?
We don't know that. I do not know that. However, I think it goes to her bias. It goes to whether she knew that her testimony was important enough to the state. And regardless of whether there was a deal that was actually worked out, this girl knew that her testimony was important to the state.
Well, you say you didn't know that, but I mean, wasn't the plea agreement a public record? You could go look at her case and look at the transcript of the plea and see if there was anything on the record indicating that she was agreeing to testify. Was that mentioned on the record in her case?
I don't know that it was. I never verified it. I have no reason to believe that her plea agreement was actually contingent upon her testimony. The point is, she knew whether or not there was actually a plea agreement that was worked out. This witness knew that her testimony was important to the state.
Well, she was the complaining witness. Are you suggesting that there was some indication that she wasn't going to testify unless she had a deal on some other charge?
No, I do not know that.
Does commission of this crime make her any less credible as a witness?
I think it goes to her motive to lie, her motive to testify a certain way. Certainly, she testified that the day of the incident she had smoked marijuana. Certainly, whether or not she is a user of methamphetamine, which was found in her bedroom, would go to her ability to recall the details of this event. She testified that she had smoked marijuana that afternoon. Certainly, this was more than a situation where it was a naive 18-year-old smoking marijuana. This was a girl who was living in a drug home. This was also a girl who her mother testified, and she testified that she lived with her mom, that she was caring for her young daughter, Althea, that there was a number of family members living in the home, and that in Indian ways, it is a custom for extended family to all live together. When the truth was, if the jury had been permitted to see the police reports, she lived in a drug home. And if they had been permitted to see the police reports, they would have known, or not heard this testimony about that incident. She wasn't that naive 18-year-old who got put in a difficult situation. The police reports, which are settled record exhibits A, B, and C, show that there was 50 grams of cocaine, ecstasy pills, and 150 grams of marijuana, all packaged for individual sale, and also $1,150. My argument is that the jury should have been given an opportunity to consider this evidence and decide for themselves what weight they wanted to give to that.
So was this a misdemeanor or a felony that she was that she entered a plea to?
She pled guilty to a felony.
And were you able to cross-examine her on that?
Yes.
And what was your cross-examination involving?
Just that isn't it true that you've been convicted of a felony?
So the jury did have in front of them that she was a convicted felon.
Correct. The next area was as to the ability to cross-examine her statements made at the hospital. During the course of the trial, there was DNA testing that was done on the contents of a rape kit that was collected at the hospital. The testing results concluded that there was a mixture of three or more DNA contributors on the boxer shorts that she was wearing when she arrived at the hospital. Ms. Sanchez had told medical staff that she had not had sexual intercourse with any other person other than my client in the last 72 hours. Despite her statements to medical staff, there were two different DNA samples found within the sperm cell fractions within the vaginal swabs, and both were in such equal concentrations that neither expert could say which was deposited first, nor could they say who was the predominant donor, and experts were able to say that either of them were likely to occur outside the last 24 hours, meaning her statements at the hospital were inconsistent with the scientific evidence.
You were able to get that evidence in, but it didn't come in until your defense. Is that correct?
It didn't come in until we had an opportunity to cross-examine. I think it was Candy Smith.
Okay. Oh, it did come in through cross-examination.
Of Candy Smith. I think Candy Smith was the last witness for the state.
For the state.
Correct. And prior to trial, the state had filed a motion in limine asking the court to preclude us from being able to offer that evidence. The state argued that it was irrelevant and that it was protected under the rape shield laws. They also argued that it was more prejudicial than probative to their case. The court ruled that it was relevant, that it did not deal with conduct, and it dealt with the nature integrity of the DNA findings. Despite the court's earlier ruling, however, we were unable to cross Ms. Sanchez about the statements that she had made at the hospital as far as not having sexual relations with anyone within the last 72 hours.
Were you able to argue this to the jury, however? Did you argue it, I guess?
We were allowed to address the issue of the scientific findings. However, to the extent that her testimony was inconsistent with the science, that her rendition of events was different than what was in the science, no, we weren't given that opportunity.
So it would have gone more to her ability to recollect or her credibility.
It could go to a number of reasons of things. It could go to her ability to call the details of the event. There was a lot of alcohol consumed that night. It could have gone to her credibility. I think the concern was that we were trying to go into specific instances of sexual conduct, which we were not trying to do. The issue was, in opening statement, the state was able to tell the jury that the DNA of both her boyfriend, Fast Horse, and an unidentified individual was found. That's in volume 1, page 56 of the transcript. Clearly, it was relevant if the state was permitted to mention it in opening statements. It was relevant from the very beginning. The state wasn't disputing the science. They weren't disputing it was there. They simply didn't want the jury to know about it.
Just an aside, was there any thought to, or did you ask to reopen your cross-examination? If the state was still presenting their case when this finally came before the court and he allowed it in, did you give any thought to asking to reopen your cross-examination?
As it was a thought that crossed my mind, and as a matter of trial tactic, given that it would give her another opportunity to make the same statements that would have been beneficial to the state or give the state an opportunity to try their case again, I chose not to do that. As far as the rape kit, the contents of the vaginal swab did not relate to specific instances of conduct. Certainly, it was relevant as to the evidence that was in the rape kit. Her statements that she made to medical staff were relevant to both her recollection of events and as to the scientific findings. 23A 2215 allows specific instances of a victim's prior sexual state that prior instances of sexual contact will not be admitted, except in cases under the exceptions where it goes to explain alternative sources of semen. That was clearly the point that we were trying to have the jury hear this evidence, was because it related to the findings within the sperm cell fraction. During the trial, the state was permitted to ask medical staff about documents included in the rape kit, including her statements to medical staff that my client raped her, but I was not permitted to offer the paper, which would have allowed the jury to hear at that point as far as her statement that she hadn't had consensual relations with anyone in the last 72 hours. Just as in other cases, DNA is very, very important in these times. The DNA is the issue as far as whether or not a person is guilty of murder. We've all heard about the Innocence Project. DNA is very important, and when detectives arrive at a homicide scene, they certainly think it's important to know who's living in the house and whose DNA might be present. In this case, it was no different. The jury had a right to know that she was making statements that there would be no other DNA, and there was. The court indicated that the statements were not relevant at the time when we were questioning Ms. Sanchez. The argument I would make is that if they weren't relevant, why are those questions asked? Why are they included in the rape kit? Ms. Sanchez signed a release at the hospital indicating that she understood that the items included in the rape kit would be included. She signed a statement at the hospital at the time that the collection was done, indicating that she understood that the purpose of the rape kit was for the criminal investigation and the proceedings related to the criminal prosecution. The statement was also that her authorization would remain in full force and effect until completion of all investigations and legal actions related to this matter, including the completion of the appeal or the expiration of the time for the filing of any such appeal or review. When she made these statements, if she read the form that she signed, she would have understood that they were for purposes of the criminal investigation. They would be included as part of the rape kit. I don't think this was a personal question that shouldn't have been expected and that we should have been able to ask her about the inconsistency of her statements versus the science.
Help me with the chronology of the trial one more time. When you were asking the victim the questions, that was before the state DNA expert testified, right?
That's correct.
So at the time you're asking the victim about other sexual activity, there really wasn't any scientific or physical evidence. You would have been cross-examining her about prior sexual relations.
I was going to cross-examine her about the statements she made at the hospital. I did not intend to get into her specific instances of sexual conduct.
But that's, I mean, her statements were about prior sexual conduct. So I guess it's kind of a catch-22 for you a little bit here, because at that time, the rape shield laws are designed to protect people who have been raped. And at that point in time, there was really no evidence to suggest, until the state DNA expert testified later, there was really no evidence to suggest there was anybody else involved, and you would have just been attacking her credibility about other instances. Isn't that really what the trial court was saying?
That's what the trial court was saying, but my argument was the state was permitted to point that out in opening. It was there. They weren't denying that there was other DNA found or that she said it. They just didn't want me asking her the question.
And then if I understand correctly, you told Justice Meyer-Henry that as a matter of trial strategy, after Candy Smith testified, then you elected not to, once it was opened up, you still elected not to come back and cross her on that point.
And that is true. In prior cases where this court has dealt with issues of child victims and statements made to medical staff, and looking at the Olson case, it was a 1989 case where a defendant objected to a doctor being permitted to testify as far as statements as that the victim had made during the investigation. And in affirming that conviction, the court relied on 1916-8, Rule 8034, which is an exception to the hearsay rule for statements given to aid medical diagnosis and treatment, and said that statements were admissible and that they were admissible even though the declarant was available as a witness.
Can you talk a little bit about this jury selection process? I don't want to throw you off here totally on your what you think are your important issues, but this same issue came up in the Daphne Wright case. Did our opinion in Daphne Wright address the concerns you have here, or do you think, is there something different about this particular case?
To the extent that the court finds that the facts in Ms. Wright are similar to the jury selection process that was used in this case, I would merely ask you to reconsider. I think the Wright decision and the previous decisions by the court have made it so that no minority in the state is ever going to be able to challenge the fact that they are being convicted by all-white juries. Even though those all-white juries are not reflecting a fair cross-section of the community.
Isn't that the problem with the whole system, is you have no way of proving and we have no way of knowing what the makeup is, what the racial makeup is, because we don't ask that question.
I think the Wright case was the only decision where there were so many potential jurors called in. It was the case where if the court wanted to consider it and understand that this is happening and why this is happening, that would have been the case. In small cases where there isn't quite as many jurors called in, you're right, we wouldn't be able to show that. But it is happening, and I understand that it's not intentional. But what I would argue is that just because it's not intentional, when you look at the language under the third prong as far as the systematic exclusion, that doesn't mean it's any less detrimental to my clients. Fairness is based on perception, and if it isn't being perceived as fair, it's not fair. My clients don't need a Juris Doctorate to know that when they look out, the minorities are the ones sitting behind the glass, and I know that we will never be in a situation where we'll be able to show that prejudice, but if women and blacks would have had to show prejudice for the right to vote, we never would have gotten that right either. The way it's being utilized and the system for using driver's licenses and voter registrations lists is not giving us juries that are a fair cross-section of our community. I know the court held that, may I finish?
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Knack, you have 20 minutes, sir.
The court, counsel. I believe my opponent began with the fourth issue that I'll address very briefly. She referred to a lot of evidence that she was claiming she hadn't been able to fully cross-examine several witnesses. I believe the first thing that she mentioned was Ashley at the time had been staying in the Sioux Falls jail at the time of the trial. Briefly addressing that, the state had put into evidence that she had been convicted of a felony, and the state had put into evidence that she had smoked marijuana and had been drinking, and the state would simply argue that anything beyond what would go to the material facts of the incident and that would go to her ability to recollect the events would be irrelevant, and the fact that she was staying at the Sioux Falls jail at the time of the trial, I don't believe that's relevant, simply because there's really been no showing or any evidence entered into the record that she had any kind of deal or that there was any kind of bias in terms of her testimony, since she, essentially in the state's case, she was the complaining victim in this crime, and she was the state's star witness, and just simply because she was also had another matter with the same office, I don't think we can just imply that there was bias there.
Do you know, did the state... I'm aware you didn't try the case, but looking at the record, did the prosecutor ever use this as part of the argument that she was an innocent casual drug user, or that
I don't believe
anything of that nature?
I don't believe so. I believe that perhaps the defendant may have thought, well, here's the evidence the state's presenting. The state, when the state was presenting this evidence, this was to give the jury a clear impression of the events surrounding the incident. We were coming out right out of the gate saying, they were at this party. Like Ms. Smith had said, they were drinking. She had been smoking some marijuana. And the jury has the right to know that this is the kind of stuff that would affect her recollection. But we weren't trying to introduce it in the sense of having it be character evidence or having it be, well, here's a picture of her we're trying to paint, and this is the evidence. We were just trying to say this is the circumstances surrounding how she may recollect the events. And then I believe that in terms of, I think you're getting to maintaining a drug residence and having the drugs in her bedroom and so forth, I would say that beyond what would be necessary to establish her ability to recollect the events, I think that's really just more of a character attack, and just attempting to paint her in a bad light and say, look, she's a bad person, you can't believe her, which I believe under 404B and our case law in this state, other acts evidence may not be admitted if its sole purpose is to establish an inference of bad character. And that's the state's position on that.
I'd like to ask you about issue number one. What evidence do you argue supports the sufficiency of the evidence to support kidnapping?
Well, I can think of at least three points at which I think there was sufficient evidence. I know that the core issue is whether or not that the kidnapping that the state charged was incidental to the crime of the rape. I'd like to, for a moment, go back and explain, because I don't believe defense counsel got into the facts as the victim had testified to. The victim had testified that the night of the incident, they were at this party, like she said, everyone had been drinking, and she wanted a ride to her boyfriend's house after the party. And the defendant had offered to give her a ride home. She agreed with him, or she agreed to go with him, and they got in the car and they left. She closed her eyes briefly, and when she opened the eyes, they were driving past her boyfriend's house. And at this time, I think the defendant had made the argument that, well, she had voluntarily left the party with the defendant, which is true, because we have case law that say, well, she may have been tricked or decoyed. We don't know when he may have formed the intent in his mind, but I think the jury could find sufficient evidence that the intent to trick her and decoy her began when she left the party with him.
Are you claiming he was already kidnapping her at that point?
Yes, I think there is sufficient evidence to make the claim that at that time he was, because he had already gotten her into an automobile and was driving away with her. And also, I also believe that our case law would support that at the time, as when she opened her eyes and saw, well, she thought she was getting a ride to her boyfriend's house, but when she saw they were driving past it and elsewhere, she asked him to turn around and take her back. I believe that at that point as well, the state's case gets even stronger, because now she's no longer under a false impression that he's taking her someplace, you know, where she wants to go. Now she's saying, okay, let me out. She's at this point been confined to the automobile, and at this point she's being removed from the location she was. Also, at this point he drove her out to a field outside of Sioux Falls, a cornfield I believe it was, and at this point, you know, he has secluded her from any possible assistance or escape, or greatly lowered her chances of assistance or escape, and at this point he commenced an assault on her. She also attempted to escape. She made a run for it, and he chased her down and tripped her and tackled her and, I think, punched her and drug her back to the automobile. And I think both taking her to the field for seclusion and the fact that she tried to escape him and then was forced back to the automobile, I think, is sufficient evidence to support kidnapping under our law.
Now, the sentence was what, 60 years for the kidnapping?
Yes.
60 years for the rape? Were those consecutive, or were those concurrent sentences? Do you know?
I believe that they were concurrent, but I'm not 100%
okay.
Sure. And like I said, I know the kidnapping law at this point states that it's both unlawful removal and unlawful confinement would count in terms of kidnapping, and I believe that at this point, through the entire events, from him removing her from the house under false pretenses to him confining her to the automobile even though she wanted to turn around, to him removing her to this secluded location that would heighten the danger that she is under, and then the attempt to escape, I think, would fall neatly within.
Well, it troubles me with that a little bit about whether or not it's incidental. Is he's driving her to the cornfield in order to commit rape on her.
Mm-hmm.
She escapes. He's bringing her back to the car. Still, his intention is to rape her. So what about either one of those was not incidental to the crime of rape?
You're
Why shouldn't he just be convicted of rape and not kidnapping?
I believe, as you know, we have the Curtis-Raymond test that we use in the state. Raymond, I'll go over briefly. That was a case where it was four defendants had been tried for rape and kidnapping. Two of those defendants had abducted a woman and brought her to, I think, an abandoned house or an abandoned warehouse, and then two more people had come, and all four of them had proceeded to rape her. And in that case, this court ruled that the two men who came later, that was mere incidental because they had not actually removed her. However, I think it's noteworthy that the two men who actually did remove her had been convicted of the rape, but I believe had been convicted of kidnapping, excuse me. In this case, I don't think that it's incidental just because of there's a whole series of events that happen of him just attempting to get her secluded away from possible assistance and escape in order for him to commit the felony. It's not that he just pushed her and held her down. It's He decoyed her into the car. He drove her to a secluded location. She attempted to escape. He prevented her and took her back to the automobile. I think it's the entire series of events that would support the kidnapping conviction.
So to avoid a kidnapping charge, would you have to have intercourse with her right in the front yard of where the party was?
No. I believe actually we have a case called State versus Lycan that deals with a woman who was kidnapped in her own bedroom simply because she's confined there, and it's the cutting off of possible assistance and escape. But I think to be incidental, it would have to be the only force used for confinement would be as much force as it took to facilitate the felony, but anything beyond where it's designed to seclude her or cut her off from assistance heightens the danger, and that's where the kidnapping comes in. I'm looking for. Oh, yes, there's specific language in the State versus St. Cloud, which states that kidnapping can be charged if the kidnapping is not an essential element of some other clearly identified crime and the victim is exposed to increased risk of harm because of the kidnapping. And I think it's that increased risk of harm that we're dealing with in this case, where the whole purpose of bringing her to the field was to cut her off from assistance. I hope I've answered your question. Satisfied?
We'll see.
We will. Getting back to issue number four, I believe we were still discussing the evidentiary issues. The rape kit, as a defense counsel indicated, I believe that we were discussing the DNA evidence and how important this was to the case and how much testimony there was. I think it's noteworthy to remember that the entire rape kit was eventually shown to the jury. The jury did know that this is the DNA that was found in the rape kit. They knew about the unknown sample that was found on the boxer shorts. They knew about the other sample of semen, I believe, from the boyfriend. This is all evidence that the jury did, in fact, hear. And the only, I believe, piece of evidence that the defense counsel did not cross-examine Ashley to was the part where she had told the medical staff that she hadn't had consensual sexual intercourse in the last 72 hours.
And is it enough that it was presented to the jury, even though they did not get the opportunity to cross-examine?
You're asking that it's enough.
Yeah, does that trump the right to cross-examine just because it comes in a different witness?
I don't believe so. I'm not sure I quite understand the question, but
well, he's raising the issue that they did not have an opportunity to cross-examine the complaining witness. Which is true. You'll agree with that. As far as she told the medical staff one thing, the DNA shows a different. They were not ever able to cross-examine the complaining witness about that, so they were not allowed to cross-examine. The fact that it comes in later, that information comes in later by another witness, does that satisfy the cross-examination right?
I believe that it does, and to the extent that they're allowed to cross-examine this other witness as to what is the relevant aspect that they wanted to get from Ashley. If I can try to clarify, the whole purpose of attempting to cross-examine her on whether or not she had consensual sex with someone in the past 72 hours goes to, could there, you know, what DNA might there be? Could there be another explanation? This is legitimate medical things we need to know for the investigation. And that evidence did come in. I think when you boil it right down, the only evidence that would come in from cross-examining Ashley about what she told the medical staff was that she was untruthful with the medical staff when she was asked if she had had sex in the last 72 hours. And I believe that because the defense was allowed to cross-examine the examiners about what all DNA was found in regards to the rape kit, that the only thing that really would have come from Ashley's testimony was the fact that she had been untruthful with the medical staff. And I don't believe that would have been relevant in terms of establishing the DNA evidence. As I said before, with the rape kit, that was brought into evidence. The only thing that was not brought into evidence at that time was Ashley's statements the medical staff, and like I said, I believe that would have simply gone to prove it, to again make another bad inference of her character, or to say, well, her recollection of the events may have been inconsistent because the DNA does not go with what she said, but I don't think it was prejudicial in that the only thing that they would have gotten from that was, well, yes, she did have sex with someone 72 hours before this rape, and there was evidence that entered into the record, so I don't believe that was prejudicial to their case. I think briefly addressing the issue of the jury selection, the state would simply, I would reiterate that, you know, we've had the Wright case just came down. We hadn't addressed that in our briefs because it was still pending at the time these briefs were submitted. We've had recent cases, I think Primal v. Dooley, that stated that our system is constitutional, and I don't believe that that the defense has brought a prima facie challenge that the jury selection that there was something improper about the jury selection. And I mean, like I said, the defense even admits that, well, even if you can meet the first two prongs of the test, there's no evidence of any systematic exclusion. So that's the state's position on that issue.
You've not run into any other states that have addressed this, that if the voter registration list and the driver's license list is somehow systemically eliminating people?
I have not done a lot of extensive research on the statistics of the other states. Most everything that I've seen has to do with, well, first getting past the prima facie challenge and then getting into what actually is a percentage-wise cross-section. But I believe the state's position would be that it's a neutral method of selection. We use voter registration and driver's license, and simply because that the result might be, the numbers alone might be, well, we don't believe that the jury composition is enough, I don't think is enough to establish under our test, simply because you can't prove systematic exclusion under the facts of this case. That is, I think, all I have on these issues, unless there are other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Knack.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Smith, you have 10 minutes.
Real quickly, this was not about whether or not Ms. Sanchez had sex with anyone else in the last 72 hours. The point is the underwear that Ms. Sanchez was wearing when she went to the hospital had the DNA of three different individuals other than herself. Two were identified, one my client, one the boyfriend. The other remained unidentified. Given the science and the way scientists are able to tell how old seminal fluid is, they testified that they were all deposited within 12 to 24 hours. Her testimony as far as what had happened the previous night leading up, her whole testimony about everything that happened was inconsistent with the science if we are to accept the science's assertions that the seminal fluid was deposited within 12 to 24 hours. That's the point that I've been trying to make. As far as the court asking the state, I think it was Justice Meyer Henry, asked the state something to the effect is, if the evidence came in, is it really a big deal that we didn't get an opportunity to cross-examine her on it?
I don't know if I said big deal. But
I didn't. I know you didn't. I apologize. If you look at the closing arguments,
is that enough to overcome your inability to cross-examine, I guess, is my question.
And my argument is that it's not enough. If you look at the closing arguments, this morning I was looking at them. The state referred to Ms. Sanchez's testimony 66 times in its closing argument. This wasn't a situation where I was trying to put her on trial. My client was the one that was on trial and was entitled to a fair trial. But the court stated on page 13, volume 5, line 13, he specifically told the jury that they could rely just on her testimony alone, and that would be sufficient to find that he raped her. He also stated to the jury that you saw what she was like on the witness stand. He told the jury that this was an 18-year-old girl four times. So even though the state did not specifically argue she's a casual drug user who smoked marijuana, even though we didn't get an opportunity to cross-examine her about the statements that she made at the hospital, The state still put a lot of emphasis on her testimony, on her statements to the police. We were not permitted to go into what had happened within the 72 hours, but in closing arguments on volume 5, page 50, the state specifically told the jury that because she had a child, that he didn't know anyone other than the Virgin Mary who hadn't had a child without having sex with anyone. The state was permitted to show that, to use it to the other direction, whereas I wasn't permitted to use it for a legitimate purpose to show that her rendition of what happened was different from the science. The state, or the court also asked the state about the kidnapping charge, and I would just argue that there was no dispute in any of the evidence that Ms. Sanchez willingly left the party with Mr. Fast Horse. The invitation to go to the party was at Myron's request. She willingly got into the car, she willingly rode to the party, and she willingly left the party. As far as there was differing testimony during the trial. At one point, she testified that he was supposed to be giving her a ride home. At another point, she testified that he was supposed to be giving her a ride to the boyfriend's house. So there was distinguishing different testimony as far as where she wanted to go and where he was supposed to be taking her. Essentially, if the court is to allow the kidnapping conviction to stand, we're stuck in a situation where every forcible rape situation is also a kidnapping. Rape is a crime of control. It is a crime where it almost always occurs in seclusion. Every victim in a forcible rape is, in essence, seized. Every victim, their freedom of movement is constrained. They can't move, otherwise they would get away. Every forcible rape that occurs through force or seclusion isn't also a kidnapping. And the state's interpretation otherwise would not be fair to people that are accused of rape.
How can you reconcile that with the two convictions in the Ryman case, though? You know, there were two convictions and two reversals there. And this is much more than what happened in the Ryman case. I mean, this woman ran from the car. She was tackled and drugged back and choked. Go ahead.
But the facts that you describe are also the same facts relied upon the state to argue that it was a forcible rape situation. I don't think the state can have it both ways. If those are the same facts that make this a forcible rape situation, then it shouldn't be the same facts that support a kidnapping conviction as well.
Under your argument, can you ever have a kidnapping then when there's a rape?
Yes. When under the law, if you remove a person a substantial distance from the vicinity of where they were at the commencement of the removal, yes. But in this case, there was no evidence that he removed her a substantial distance from the vicinity of where she was at the commencement of the removal. She willingly got into the car, and it wasn't an unlawful removal.
She didn't ask for a ride to a cornfield.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.